Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Dale, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. In May of 1881, the Chicago Tribune newspaper reported on a new ordinance that it said was aimed at getting rid of street obstructions. And as it turns out, the obstructions were human. And let me read to you the text of this ordinance that was indeed passed and went into law there in the city of Chicago. Whereas the streets and sidewalks of the city of Chicago contain numerous beggars, mendicants, organ grinders, and other unsightly and unseemly objects, which are a reproach to the city, disagreeable to people upon the streets, an offense to business houses along the streets, and often dangerous, therefore, be it ordered that the mayor at once take steps to remove from the streets all beggars, mendicants, and all those who, by making exhibition of themselves and their infirmities, seek to obtain money from people on and along the streets. As it turns out, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, there were many cities across the country in the West, the Midwest, and the Northeast that had similar ordinances on their books. And it seems pretty clear that the main idea here was to deal with beggars on the city streets. However, people who worked in the area of disability rights have pointed to these laws and have said these really tell us a great deal about how we think about, feel about people who are disabled. And in fact, they have referred to them in a generic kind of sense as ugly laws. In this part of Focus 580, we will talk a little bit about the history of these kinds of ordinances, and our guest for the program is Susan Schweik. She's the author of a recently published book, and the title of the book is The Ugly Laws, Disability in Public. The book is published by the New York University Press. Our guest, Susan Schweik, is professor of English and also co-director of the Disability Studies Program at the University of California, Berkeley, and she's joining us this morning by phone. Questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Questions are invited. We ask people, though, please be brief in your comments so we can move along and get in as many callers as possible. And please stay on the topic, but otherwise input from people who are listening is certainly welcome. Again, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. Professor Schweik, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I think this is a fascinating subject. It is something that before I picked up the book and started looking at it, I had no idea such laws at one time existed. And I'm sure a lot of people would be perhaps surprised to know that many cities, City of Chicago and others, had them, and that they remained in many cases certainly into the 20th century. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to tell people about something that chances are they had never heard of before.
Yeah, you're very typical. I think most people haven't heard about them unless they happen to have been in the disability rights community, in which case they will definitely have heard about them, although in a an interesting, important, but somewhat distorted way.
Yeah. Well, that's something here that I think is a main feature of the story that you're telling. And as a way, we can get into some depth, but as a way of starting out to talk about this, the people who are disability, are and have been disability rights activists, have said, look at this now. This really does tell us something about how we think about disabled people and their rights. Is that a fair reading of these laws and what motivated them?
Yes and no. It's a fair reading of the laws, I would say. It's not a fair reading of what motivated them. And I think that an accurate understanding of the laws involves keeping in mind what impelled the disability rights activist community to remember the laws in these ways, and then also to try to shift the focus. So the law, the wording of the law that flashed through the country, cities all over the country enacted this law over a long period of time. The wording was, no person who's diseased, maimed, deformed, so as to be an unsightly or disgusting object shall expose himself to public view. That's the core common wording in most of the versions of this law. So the fact that so as to be an unsightly or disgusting object is legal language in city ordinances across the U.S., and the fact that the wording begins, no person who is diseased, maimed, or deformed, and the fact that it, in theory at least, is a blanket prohibition of exposing oneself to public view, which is an ambiguous phrase, all these things make it appropriate to have a kind of strong polemical reading of what this law was about, that it was a prohibition against walking while disabled, as we now would say, disabled, being on the street as disabled. Now, in practice, that is not really what it was about. And what has been lost in the memory of the law since the 1970s, when disability activists who were organizing to create the series of laws and structures that led to the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990, when the law was rediscovered, which happened in the mid-70s, what was lost from the history of the law was a really basic fact, which is probably pretty obvious to a lot of listeners, which is that this law was never leveled at Helen Keller or Franklin Delano Roosevelt. If you were a well-off person with connections, even in the most large and somewhat anonymous city, you were not going to be targeted by this law. This law was directed against poor disabled people, people without means. It was only illegal to be unsightly if you didn't have means, and it was specifically, primarily, although not exclusively, directed against beggars. It was largely an anti-begging ordinance that prohibited people begging on the street from exposing a sore or showing the fact that they only had one leg or making it obvious that they were blind or something like that and attempting to garner alms by doing that.
Yeah. And also as part of this, there was, I think on the parts of many people, the idea that there were individuals who in fact weren't disabled who were putting this on, who were literally faking as a way of trying to collect money.
Right. I love literally faking. Yeah, I mean, to a great extent, the proponents of these laws in cities would advocate for them or justify them by saying, don't worry about that. I'll use the C word, that poor cripple on the street corner over there. Don't worry about the fact that there's no safety net, that, you know, this is a very difficult situation for that person, because that person isn't really disease, maimed, or deformed. That person is faking it. And to some extent, as with all dynamics about begging in any culture, and in U.S. culture, modern U.S. culture, very much so, there's always a question of, is the person deserving? Is the person feigning? Is the person having us on, manipulating? And that question, of course, was still a live question, even if it was perfectly obvious that the person had no legs or whatever. But the general assumption was that more egregious faking was occurring almost all of the time, or even all of the time. There are actually lines from proponents of the law who say there really are no deserving deformed people begging on the streets. They're all fakers. And one of the things I did in the book is not just attempt to repudiate that, although it's important to recognize the extent to which people in for real dire straits, because they were ill or disabled and could not work and had nowhere to go and nothing else to do but somehow try to get on the street and participate in the street economy, whether it was through begging or peddling. Anyway, to recognize that although those people were very seriously hurt by the story that circulated that said that they were just faking it, there were also, of course, lots of people who were faking it, or, you know, people in a kind of middling category who were exaggerating. And begging is a kind of performance. And one of the things I tracked in the book was the wild history of actual bars in the Bowery in New York, but there were also bars on Clark Street in Chicago and in other cities across the U.S. that catered to two kinds of clientele. They served actual, what we would now call disabled people who were on the street, and they also served people who faked it. And those two groups of people would mix, and it probably were hard to tell apart at some time. And the bars had names like the doctors and the cripples home and the hospital. And the wildest thing that happened there was that there were what get called now by some historians and writers cripple factories, where people could rent a sling or a crutch or an eye patch or whatever and be trained, possibly by actual blind or paralyzed people or whatever, to properly simulate blindness or paralysis. And then the money would be pooled. And this was a real live kind of outlaw culture in these cities, and it drove many city leaders and charity organizers really crazy, and they wanted to stop it. And so this interested me a lot as part of the phenomenon, part of, you know, many, many different factors that went into the culture of this law, and to think about it, to try to think about it seriously without just scoffing at it or ignoring it, was part of the project of the book.
Well, again, to come back to the question I asked at the beginning, though, you're trying to see this, to look at this in a as being something that's complicated, though, to what extent does it still say something like, we would just rather not see these people?
That's right.
We would prefer them to be invisible, and that it certainly connects with ideas of class and concerns about immigrants and poor people and all that, but that it's a, is it a way of rendering, trying to render these people invisible?
Yes, absolutely. It reflects an irrational, emotional aversion to the sight of disability and to the sight of bodily vulnerability and anomaly, to the sight of the things that make us most who we are, you know, to our animality and our most basic humanity and mortality, and also aversion and fear and revulsion about human difference of all sorts, and particularly about certain kinds of human difference. I think about things like spasticity, for instance, or drooling, the history of terrible oppression that has happened to people who might drool. I write in the book about a court case that involves schooling, about a very bright boy who basically was excluded from school, and the courts justified it on the grounds that he disgusted his teacher and classmates. And now we cannot get away with that in the same way legally in the U.S., but we certainly see the dynamics in practice all the time. And one of the things I write about very early on in the book is a friend of mine who would be identified as disabled now, and who talked to me when I started talking to him about this, about being a kid who, he said, walked funny, and seeing a man walking down the street of his, I think, suburban hometown, who was obviously disabled, and feeling completely enraged and mortified at the sight of that man was in public and embarrassing him. And he said to me, and it's the line I've really held through this project, he said, we all write our own ugly laws, and then we have to write through them. And so certainly part of what the book is about is the history of appearance discrimination, still very alive and well. It's still ugly out there. It may take different, slightly more hidden forms. Also the history of literal sequestering and segregation, because these laws very often came directly on the heels of a city developing its first almshouse or new county hospital, or later on the more medical kind of specialized scientific-sounding institutions that we now have. but especially almshouses and poorhouses. San Francisco, which is the first city I know of to enact the law, opens its first almshouse and enacts a law instantaneously. And so the law is very connected historically to the development of institutions to literally shut disabled people away, out of sight. And it was a worse fate in some ways to be picked up under the law and sent to the county home than to be sent to jail, because sentencing to the county home was an indeterminate sentence and perfectly possibly a sentence for life.
Well, and what it makes me think about is the way that this also connects to the kind of eugenic thinking that was really gathering steam probably in late 19th and into the early 20th century, where a variety of conditions could be physical disability, mental disability, mental illness, substance abuse, but also poverty itself were considered to be something that not just maybe you had, but something that you were, and that the way that society could be rid of such people, first of all, was to get them off the street, to round them up, to institutionalize them, and then also make sure that they did not reproduce.
Yes, absolutely. You're so right, and that was beautifully put, and they're so interconnected. And the ugly laws start a little earlier than the peak of eugenic thinking, but they absolutely paved the way for it. And once eugenics really gets going, they're completely intertwined. So they paved the way in part, as just in the way you just said, that they legally offer an understanding that there is a category of person, an objective legal category of person, who is a diseased, maimed, deformed person. Not only that, but who is an unsightly and disgusting person. The first law in San Francisco, the heading of the law says, an ordinance to prohibit begging or the appearance of certain persons on the streets. So there's the ambiguity of the law's work right there in that heading. And the idea that there are certain persons, and they're bad enough that they can't appear in public, it is absolutely setting the groundwork and part of the same culture that then produces eugenic laws as another way to get those people out of sight. You nip it in the bud.
Mm-hmm.
You incarcerate them in almshouses, and as eugenic thinking really took off, there was less fear, actually, about the kind of leakiness or insufficiency of almshouses and poorhouses, because the problems with almshouses and poorhouses is that people could go in and out of them. They weren't secure enough. But once institutions develop, and eugenics develops along with them, the idea is you're not going to really have to worry anymore about these people being out on the street, because they're going to be taken care of long before that, either shut away or later, of course, medically fixed, or they're not going to exist to begin with. And the other link to eugenics is that the same people who were policed by these unsightly beggar ordinances were exactly, as you say, the people who were the targets of eugenics. And there were many groups, prostitutes and sex workers, for instance, certain immigrant groups, of course, racially targeted groups, people who would be defined as sexual deviants. These groups were understood in their very being and in their practices to produce disease, which then produced deformity. And it was crucial in order to prevent disease and deformity to sterilize
yeah.
them, or worse, if not to actively euthanize them, although that also was developing in the culture of this time, to be perfectly comfortable with them dying off at alarming rates in the almshouse.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Susan Schweik. She's professor of English and co-director of the Disability Studies Program at the University of California, Berkeley, and is the author of the book, The Ugly Laws, Disability in Public, published by the New York University Press. Questions welcome. We have some callers here who have been patient. We'll get right to them. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go to Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I have a question and a comment, David, if I might. If your guest could explain the psychology of what she's talking about and how that affects social existence. And my comment is my experience in Chicago over the last 25 years, going and coming just as a visitor, the existence of the street beggars, mostly black, and with styrofoam cups, I think up into the 90s or near 2000, were still there. And I think there was some move to remove those people, and they did. And then the newspaper, I can't remember exactly the title of the newspaper that existed, that the homeless and other beggary played into, and selling them on the street, which were mostly black vendors, you know, just walking with the crowds. And the other experience of mine goes back. I'm 75 years old and grew up in Terre Haute, Indiana. My experience in life, I was probably 9 years old in the fifth grade, and some of my schoolmates asked me, without any hesitation, why I was ragged and why I stank and why I was dirty. Well, they didn't understand where I came from, which was abject poverty and the bathing, communal bathing in a number three tub, wearing ragged clothes, unwashed, where no washing machines and such as that. And one of my pairs of trousers had a rip in the lower leg, and I rolled that one up to cover that up. But I didn't have any idea or the reasoning behind at that young age why I appeared like I did, and the response of schoolmates who were better off. There was not that many in the neighborhood I was from. That's when they shipped black kids to the south end of Terre Haute, black schools. And the situation was such, and I never reflected on it until I became older. But that is part of parcel to the poverty syndrome that continues to haunt socialization. And I'll ring off and listen on the radio. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that's a lot. You can respond to whatever that, however you like.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for that call. And I guess I just want to respond a little first to what you said right at the end about the poverty and that powerful story you just told. And to think about the ways in which the suspicion and the inquiry and the being the object of someone who can be asked a question like that affects the people who experience it. And poverty in and of itself, without anything else, can render people, in the terms of my book, ugly, unsightly, disgusting, to be shunned. And then in terms of the larger questions you ask, I'm struck by I think we all understand the persistence of this phenomenon. And these laws are a really good example of completely failed laws. They just utterly didn't work. They don't make it go away at all. And one of the lessons, I think, is that any measure today that attempts to clean up the streets in some way or other through a legal ordinance is not going to succeed. Yes, in Chicago, to a huge extent, as the 20th century wore on, street begging became a largely African-American phenomenon. And I write in the book about the complicated history of, particularly about African-American history in relation to this subject. And Chicago is a really important resource, the Chicago archives, especially because of things like the Chicago Defender, the African American paper, tell us a lot about how this phenomenon was actually experienced by people who were begging and by people who passed them and tried to figure out what to do about it. On the question of psychology, I'm not a psychologist, and that's a really complicated question, and I haven't focused on it in the book because I didn't feel qualified to. I think that this law, on the one hand, it's I think memorable and shocking because it others people so dramatically. The fact that disgusting is a legal word in the law, I keep going back to that. The fact that there is a person who is policed by the law, and by definition, it is not us. Very often when cities would enact this law in the city council meetings, I would look at the minutes of the meetings, these handwritten minutes, and there would be the dog-catching ordinance that got enacted, and then there would be the street extension that got enacted, and then there would be the enactment of the unsightly beggar ordinance. When I go and look at the city newspaper, often cities had a little column on a certain day of the week that would report on what the city council had voted on. And I can't tell you how frequently this occurred. I would look at the article in the city newspaper, and there would be the dog-catching ordinance and the street extension, and there wouldn't even be a mention of this law. And I don't know why that is. Possibly it embarrassed people, but I think it's even more likely that it wasn't even seen to be of that much importance to the readers, who were by definition not the people who were going to be picked up under the law. So on the one hand, I think there's just a way in which the law enacts, one of many laws that enact, and we haven't remembered the history well enough in the case of disability, as opposed to, say, race, where our culture has a much liver memory. It enacts othering. On the other hand, if you want my amateur psychologist's opinion, I think it has a whole lot to do with our own experience of our own vulnerability, our mortality, the fact that we can get sick. It scares us. Our memories of being infants and utterly dependent on other people, and the way these bodily experiences, everything that makes our bodies unstable and changing and frightening to us, the way those get projected onto the body of another person. I don't think, though, that psychology directly historically motivated the creation of these laws, but I think it has everything to do with their dynamics in the culture and with dynamics that still persist, even though it is impossible to arrest someone under this law today.
Let's talk with another caller in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? This is a very interesting subject, especially the laws you have found. The word disgusting, it would be the extreme to beauty, and then you backtrack to the idea of what is normal or common. So people basically, and you're right, I think you're correct in your amateur psychology, where you would project your own, you would see someone with missing limbs and say, what would I be like that? But I find it interesting that these things become codified in law, because I think beauty and normalcy is codified in advertising now, where you have, you know, the beautiful model, or you have the ideal home, family, whatever, the ideal car. So in a sense, you have to almost like talk about the extreme, what is classically considered beautiful, like the Greeks, or symmetry in bodies, which would be missing limbs or something like that. But that's sort of built into us, I think, or wired into us. I mean, if you're whatever normal is, and how society is defined normal, and how, you know, you can look at people that are not like you, others, and, you know, you can think of yourself as better or worse off, sort of something like that. So I'll hang up, and thanks. I'll listen to you off air. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, thank you. Great comment. And you're right. I think today, largely, we do our policing of our appearance ourselves, and we do it pharmaceutically. We do it through cosmetic products. I think about when Playboy magazine ran an article talking about this law quite a while ago now, a few decades ago. The article was called Appearancism in Chicago, because, by the way, Chicago just got completely unfairly marked as the city of this law. But anyway, the article in Playboy was called Appearancism in Chicago, and somewhere in there, I don't remember if it's a heading or if it's an actual sentence in the article, it says, better check the mirror before heading outside in Chicago. Now, in a way, this is a problem with focusing much on this law, because it's such an extreme case, and the dynamics today aren't codified, as you put it. They aren't taken care of by law. They're taken care of by, you know, our watching of ourselves. And do we need cosmetic surgery, or what kinds of range of practices do we need to do to make sure that we're attractive, that we're aesthetically pleasing, and that we're also normal? And I love your comment about the Greek. One of my favorite quotations in the book is from a man who was part of the Charity Organization Society, which is an extremely active presence in terms of promoting and pushing for the enforcement of these laws, a whole movement, a whole really broad, important cultural movement in the U.S., the Charity Organization Society. But one of these charity organizers writes an article, and he says, well, it's really important for us to figure out what is normal and to do everything we can to promote it eugenically, for instance, and by other health practices. And he says we need to look back at Greek statues to see not only what's beautiful but also what's normal. They present our classic model of what's normal. But then he goes off into this little digression. And he says, well, the problem is that a lot of them have excrescences on them and grotesqueries. And so even the Greek statues, you know, the Venus de Milo or whatever, even the models that we would go back to, the classical models, they already are not good enough for us. But the broad phenomenon of policing the normal, of course, is developing. It started earlier, 18th century, but developing with intensity during the period of these laws, which went basically from largely 1880s to World War I, although the first law that I found is 20 years earlier than the 80s. But anyway, the project of doing what Leonard Davis calls enforcing normalcy is taken over now by much more informal methods of self-disciplining. And it means caution about what exactly we're doing when we remember this law, because it doesn't help us focus on that issue very well.
Mm-hmm. Our guest, Susan Schweig, is professor of English and co-director of the Disability Studies Program at the University of California, Berkeley. And we're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in her book, The Ugly Laws, Disability in Public. It is published by the New York University Press. We have another caller here to get in, and they are in Champaign on our line one.
Hello.
Hello. Yes.
I've got two questions. One is, well, I guess it's more a comment. If the parents have a, quote, normal, close quote, child who later becomes disabled, this must be very frightening for the parents with all these preconceptions and things tending toward mythology that they may have heard. That's one comment. My other question or statement, disabled people are often encouraged to marry, quote, normal, close quote, people. Is this so they can become more, quote, acceptable, question mark, close quote?
I love your quotes.
That's it. That's my question.
I wish I could keep putting them in my comments. Great questions, and I think I guess on the second point, one of the things that interested me in writing this book is how much we all struggle with the culture of the unsightly beggar ordinances, no matter who we are or what our positioning. And the other thing I want to say is one of the main reasons I wrote it was not to represent the history of this really weird, awful law so much, as to celebrate the history of the culture that has both remembered it and also undone it. So that disability arts culture, starting in the 70s and the 80s, has used it really vibrantly, has played around with it, has made fun of it, has remembered it with horror and anger, And that all these aspects of that disability, arts culture and political disability movement culture, which I think are often reduced to kind of whininess or frivolous lawsuit making or whatever in this culture, or ignored, known very little about, they are vibrant tools, they are vibrant resources for us now, so that anyone who, as we all will, if we're lucky enough and don't just die very quickly, anyone who at some point begins to deal with impairment, anyone who has someone they love who is dealing with that issue, has the resources of this culture available. And given this kind of history, the kind of history of the actual people who I talk about in the book, because I tried as much as I could, it's hard to find it because their histories are so buried, but I tried to find stories of specific people who were hurt by this law. What counterbalances that is the stories of specific people who, out of that situation, affirmed themselves, regarded themselves with respect and dignity and pleasure. And so that's a lot what the book is meant to be about.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller for the comment. We're coming into about our last 13 minutes here on the program, and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I hope this is not too much of a side journey here, but one of the things that really struck me in looking at the book was you talked about the fact that these ordinances, the very, very first one that you could find, 1867, San Francisco, and that they spread across the country and that you found them in many cities in the West, the Midwest, and the Northeast. In the South, you didn't find them.
Yeah.
You have some idea of why it was that in Southern cities they didn't have these laws on their books?
Yeah, I have a little idea, although I think it would take a really good historian, and I'm not one, and then a really good historian of the South to really account for it. But again, my rather amateur speculations about it would include the fact that other municipal ordinances that were policing behavior and were so caught up with post-slavery and Reconstruction politics and race and poverty politics in the South were doing the work that the ugly law needed to do in the North, ruthlessly doing the work, and so were maybe less necessary. A vagrancy law in and of itself, and Brian Wagner has written about this, the ways in which vagrancy law policed, for instance, the bodies of ex-slaves, the lives of ex-slaves, harshly, it replaced slavery. And that's one thing. The other thing is, of course, the effects of the Civil War, the devastation, the sheer amount of disease, maiming, deformity in parts of the country that had been as impacted as the South was. And in those cases, I think it's less likely for the law to develop. And the third thing I would say is it's for longer, it's uneven development of the country. So it's more rural, communities are smaller, people know each other more, and police each other through more informal social means. So this law develops, I think it's one of the reasons why it develops so early in San Francisco, in situations where there are a lot of strangers, a lot of others, a lot of immigration, for instance. And people don't know each other, and cities start in ways that are really pretty comical, trying to adjudicate every little kind of behavior on the street in order to deal with this new situation where all of a sudden what we're familiar with now, if we have lived in a big city, was very new at the time. And also I think probably, I don't know enough about it, but industrialization is a huge factor. And the dealing with industrial injury and just trying to manage this kind of modern phenomenon of greater, maybe not greater numbers of injury, almost certainly not, but different kinds of injury and people not knowing each other. So I think in the South there were different kinds of networks and different and in some ways both more flexible seems a weird word to use, but I'll use it, and much more extreme forms of social control that were happening.
Do you have any idea how many people, at least initially, that were the target of these laws would have been disabled Civil War veterans?
I don't know what percentage, but I think on the one hand they would have been more likely to steer clear of the laws because war veterans often got greater license, and in some cities there are exceptions. In Chicago, for instance, they originally entertained an exception that said a one-armed or one-legged veteran is an exception. I guess, you know, if there were, you know, if you were brain injured or whatever, that wouldn't be an exception. But one arm or one leg, it's like, okay, we understand, you served your country. And, of course, after the Civil War, there's a tremendous, interesting culture of pride around war and injury. You see things like left-handed penmanship contests for veterans, and they write essays to show how well they can write with their left hand. But then what they say is things like, I have the mark of manhood. You know I was not a coward. They wouldn't say I'm deformed. They would say, this is the sign that I was a man. So you have that going on, and veterans get breaks. Sometimes they get allowed to beg. They get given licenses where no one else does. On the other hand, though, the developing veterans compensation systems in the U.S. and the arguments about how veterans would be compensated, like are all veterans going to get pensions or only ones that have been hurt? And then, of course, back to faking, how do you prove that it was a war injury?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you prove it's not psychologically exaggerated? All these dynamics we still see today. Mm-hmm. And war injury could be faked as much as anything else. And so in San Francisco, for instance, right at the dawn of the law, people are very upset by a guy who has lost his leg in a fever of some kind and is setting himself up as a war veteran and begging on the street. So both those factors are at play whenever war injury comes in the mix. Mm. But there definitely is even greater ambivalence when war injury is in the mix. And one of the most important factors that leads to the demise of these laws is World War I and the culture grappling with what it owes to disabled war veterans. And as a result of that, the development of modern rehabilitation, vocational rehabilitation, and also, of course, occupational, medical, social rehabilitation.
We're getting short on time. We have a couple of callers. We'll try to get them in. They can help us by being brief. We have someone, obviously, who's listening online in Oakland, California. Line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Welcome from Oakland. Great show. You've talked about how these laws about ugliness and deformity and disability have keep things hidden. I'm sort of interested in the other side is where ugliness and disability have been portrayed in movies and on TV and in literature. It seems like there's a whole different approach. It's almost romanticized and almost glorified in some ways. I'm wondering if you have some things to say about that, the kind of public portrayal when it finally goes public about the kind of issues you're talking about.
Yeah, thanks, Oakland.
Sure.
This is exactly the case in this culture, that on the one hand, you can't go to a movie theater. I guarantee you, if you go to a Cineplex today, you know, something that has 16 movies, and you just watch through them, you will see disability issues everywhere. And, of course, actors famously can win Academy Awards by faking, essentially, by playing a disabled person. So on the one hand, disability is just hyper-visible in this culture. It's symbolically overloaded. It always gets displayed. And one of the things I wrote about in the book is how much this was true, say, in Chicago, in the same period that had the law, all the different ways in which it was civically sanctioned and culturally inevitable that disabled people would be appearing in public, at least in the form of people acting like them. On the other hand, there is a history of censorship that is kind of the equivalent of the history of these laws, so that in World War I, you find people like Cecil B. DeMille putting out casting calls for disabled people to play injured war victims. And one of the heroes of my book, who's a guy who was on the street, who was run out of Brooklyn under the ugly law, and then wrote the book on the ugly law, which he self-published and sold like one of those street newspapers that, people who beg now, not beg, but people sell on the street in Chicago. This was his own self-published equivalent. He was in Cecil B. DeMille war films because that was there was a real premium put on realism, and it was a kind of heyday for disabled people to be in Hollywood. Well, what happens a few years later in the 20s is that there begin to be enacted medical censorship laws. There were actually laws that said you cannot show on the film disease, maiming, deformity. That wasn't the words they used, but that was what the laws were about. And that is part of the reason why now, today, we have, you know, Denzel Washington playing a quadriplegic rather than an actual quadriplegic playing a quadriplegic. It's one of the many reasons, the even bigger reason being, again, it goes back to the psychology issue. But at a certain point in the history of film, it was illegal to have an actual quadriplegic shown on the screen.
Wow. Thanks.
All right. Very interesting. Thanks for the comment. We'll go to one more here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
I wanted to mention that unemployment figures in recent years for the blind and partially sighted has been between 70 and 75%, mm-hmm. Which is extremely high. And so I was thinking, you know, if not for programs such as Social Security Disability Insurance, a lot of those people would be on the streets.
Absolutely, and these things are completely interconnected. The you know, when you think about the ways in which different aspects of the culture of this law are still enacted today, this is one obvious one we see. People, this law might as well police the workplace, given the unemployment rate for disabled people in this country. And again, to go back to the positive aspects of the book, one of the most exciting things I found was this treasure load of autobiographies by people who did not have any Social Security safety net of any kind, and so they had no choice but to be on the streets if they didn't have families, and if they didn't want, if they wanted to avoid the almshouse. And many of them, an astonishing number of them, wrote autobiographies, which they then sold on the street to try to make a living. And some of those autobiographies have survived. I have a chapter in the book about them. And the ones I loved the best, aside from the one who wrote the kind of legal critique of the ugly law, were the blind autobiographers who were mainly dictating. And I just recommend the book, which, by the way, is on Bookshare. So for visually impaired readers, it is available on tape through Bookshare.
That's good to know.
But anyway, the footnotes to that chapter about the blind autobiographies, I just recommend finding those autobiographies. It's amazing to find these forefathers, not really foremothers in that case, but, you know, who were writing in 1903 or whatever about their experience of looking for work, doing work, and not finding work.
I see. Could I ask one more question, please,
sure.
About the the photograph on the cover of your book, which I'm looking at online. There's a photo of a blind woman with a sign around her neck that says blind. But right above that, she appears to be wearing some kind of metal badge that has a number on it.
Mm-hmm.
Could you describe?
Yeah, great question. It's a little engraved metal badge, and it is her permit to beg. And she was in New York City, and at that moment in time in New York, the mayor's office did give a certain number of permits for people to beg. Now, the autobiographies I'm talking about, many of them recount in detail what a strange, maddening, kind of double-bind system this permit system was. A mayor might be giving out permits in the same city that had the ugly law, and people could literally get arrested, say, I have a permit from the mayor, be released, go out on the street again, get arrested again. The ambivalence that cities had about what to do about the problem of poor disabled people was so great that they had completely contradictory policies. But anyway, there were permitting systems so that if you were determined to be one of the deserving poor, you might get a permit, as this woman did. And that photograph is by the famous modernist photographer Paul Strand, who took his photos with a little camera that took a picture sideways, so it looked like he was focusing on something else. And it's in the Museum of Modern Art. And in its full version, if you see it on the wall, it's quite beautiful. In the cover, it's cropped up quite close. And I'm ambivalent about the cover. It's a stunning photograph. I was ambivalent about having any picture of anyone who might be identified as disabled next to the word ugly on the cover. But there is a lot of dignity in that picture and a very eloquent face of that woman.
I wish that we had more time. There are even more things here than that we could talk about. But I don't want to launch into another question because I wouldn't really be able to give you the opportunity to make a very good answer. So what we're going to just have to do is to finish up. But I think the book is very, very interesting, and there are a lot of things to think about here. So I would certainly suggest to folks that you look for the book. The title, once again, is The Ugly Laws. The subtitle is Disability in Public. It's published by the New York University Press by our guest, Susan Schweik. She's professor of English. She's also co-director of the Disability Studies Program at the University of California at Berkeley. And Professor Schweik, just thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.